You are listening to the Drunken Pen Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Caleb James. With me today, Spencer Church.
Yep,
I didn't come up with a name for you today, but I'll give you one at the end. I'll just slap it in real
half-hazard. Yeah, that sounds good.
Post-production. We're behind schedule today. Spencer, the Bayside Boat Buster Church. Today, the editorial director and co-publisher of Philadelphia Stories Magazine and PS Books, and author of the book More Strange Than True from Sagging Meniscus Press, our special guest today, CJ Spataro. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Have you done because I usually look up the guest on, you know, the old podcast circuit before. I didn't see you come up on anything. Have you done podcasts before or anything of the sort?
You are my first podcast. I have done a couple of radio interviews at this point, but I have some podcasts scheduled for later in the spring, but you're my first.
Well, that's good. You could have low expectations. Yes. So if this one's terrible, like I said, off air, we don't have video and our listener base is usually pretty immature anyway, so you don't really have to worry about accidentally making a fool of yourself, because that generally is our job. So your book is really interesting. The synopsis for it, not to just crib off your website, this is actually from the Sagging Meniscus site. Because when Tarina reached out and mentioned that you would be interested in coming on the podcast, her selling of it, of the book, was I think a woman takes mushrooms and it's like a Midsummer Night Dream retelling, but it, you know, in a different kind of way. But the actual synopsis here, I don't know if this is what you would put on the, because this is a forthcoming book. This isn't out yet, right?
Right. No, it doesn't come out until June.
Okay. So just from the Sagging Meniscus Press site. After an epically shitty day, Joel Jameson unknowingly eats a magic spiked meal and happens also to make a certain wish. And that's why she awakes the next morning to discover her beloved dog Oberon has been transformed into a beautiful naked man in her bed. I mean, you love when that happens. Conflict ensues when Titania, the impulsive queen of the fairies, decides she wants Oberon for herself. Is Oberon simply a man who used to be a dog, or is he somehow something more? When Jewel discovers the answer, she will be faced with a devastating choice. Will she choose to save the man she's grown to love by giving him up, or will she honor his wishes and watch him die? So, like a Midsummer's Night Dream, but I would imagine a nice modern twist.
Yeah, I mean, most of the characters are pulled from, at least the fairy characters all come from A Midsummer Night's Dream. I don't really use a ton of the plot because the play is very silly in many ways, and the plot is difficult to follow. So, but I do use some of the things from the play, and definitely a lot of the characters, and also some fairy characters from mythology. She doesn't technically eat magic mushrooms, which of course, you know, makes sense that we would have. It's a meal that has been imbued with magic, and she doesn't realize it. There are mushrooms in the meal, but
that makes
not,
it
like.
That makes it a little more fairy tale esque. That's a lot less what I was thinking of, like a Hunter S. Thompson Fear and Loathing mixed with Shakespeare kind of situation. This sounds pretty enjoyable though. So what gave you the idea to put a twist on that story? And I mean, a lot of people, I actually know a lot of writers personally who've written different tales set in A Midsummer's Night's Dream. And then just from looking through the first chapter of your book, I noticed, like, I think one of the restaurants or cafes is Puck's. So you do the name dropping, but you actually made it, an original work. So you're not using the plot. So what gave you the idea to have a magical meal that goes awry?
Well, it's like when you're writing, these things just kind of come about, as, at least for me anyway, I don't really plan anything so much. So I just write and I'm kind of hoping for the best. And as I write, I'm figuring the story out and thinking about things. So in this case, I had this premise of an idea, which seemed at the time fairly small, but, you know, it's just like, you know, what if this super lonely woman decides, or, you know, looks at her dog one day when she's feeling really bad for herself and, you know, kind of makes this goofy wish, like, you know, why can't I find a man who loves me like you, and blah blah, something like that. And And then I just started thinking like, well, if that were to happen and, you know, the dog were somehow like transformed into a man, how would that work? Who would do it? And I started thinking, oh, I guess I need some fairies or some kind of magic to turn him into a man. Then I was like, oh, great. Now I got to come up with a whole like world and do all this world building. And that's really always super challenging. So I just thought, well, there's all these fairies in this whole world, this whole hierarchy in Midsummer Night's Dream. So, and I really love adapting things and kind of putting Easter eggs in stories, you know, for people who may be familiar with whatever has inspired me. Hopefully, like, you won't have to have read A Midsummer Night's Dream or even have seen it or know anything about it in order to enjoy the novel. But if you have, there will definitely be things for you to find, I hope.
So just from your academic background, you just gravitate towards, I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream is probably my favorite Shakespeare that I've read just because it's so whimsical and it's fun. And a lot of times when people think of Shakespeare, yeah, they don't necessarily think fun. Like I said, yeah, I know a few people who've done their own adaptations of it, and there is a lot to play with, even if you're just using the general premise or the characters themselves. So when Tarina reached out and just mentioned that, that automatically hooked me. I was like, oh, I want to check this book out. And then just from the, I think it was like an ARC copy she sent me, just like the font type, like the typesetting and like the cap drops, it all gave that whimsical atmosphere. So if that comes out when the book comes out, like if that's how it's printed up, I think it's going to be really well done.
No, oh, thanks. Yeah, I really like that too. I think that's the plan. So we're still working on the cover, but I think that's what the inside of the book is going to look like.
Do you have a lot of say in the cover since Saggy Meniscus is a smaller press? Like, do you get the, whether it's the artist or just like, you know, here's an idea I have, maybe we could do something with this?
Well, I did talk to Jacob, the publisher. He did ask me if I had any ideas or if there was anything I really wanted to see on the cover. And really the only thing I thought about was having a poodle on the cover somewhere. That seemed to make the most sense to me. I do have some input. I do, you know, get to share my thoughts about it, what I think about cover and all that kind of stuff. Ultimately, it's up to Jacob, the publisher, to make the decisions about what he wants on the cover and what he thinks is going to help sell the book the best. And, you know, it really depends on your contract and all kinds of stuff. You know, I know people who've published with big five publishers who've had a lot of say in their covers and or who've had absolutely no say in their covers. So I think a lot of it is really sort of outlined in your contract.
I mean, it's kind of sad to say, but just in the modern reader landscape, a cover can often sell a book more than I think in the past. You get minimal readers as is now. So if they're walk, especially if it's just general audience walking through a Barnes & Noble or a local bookstore, if they see that really good cover that pops out to them, they're more likely to check it out than if they just see, which a lot of the big publishers do now, are these bland digital covers that anybody could slap together in 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think a cover is, it's really important. It's like one of the biggest marketing tools you have when you're trying to sell a book and you're trying to find readers. That cliche, can't tell a book by its cover, is true, but, you know, a cover is definitely the first thing that readers look at. It's the first thing they see. It's the thing that is going to attract them to turn it over and read the back flap and then maybe take a look at the, you know, the opening pages. I know people who read the last few pages of a book before they buy it. I don't know why they do that, but I do know people who do that. So yeah, but you have to get them to walk over to the shelf and pick up the book first. And the best way to do that is to have a really engaging cover.
Right. So you did something interesting in your opening chapter. I've seen this pop up more and more, but I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction. So when I stumble across, because it's something I've done in my own work, but I never really knew what the proper formatting was, and that's text messaging. So if you do, like in your book, it looks like somebody actually, I don't know if it's images with, you know, but they're in like the bubble that they're supposed to be in, just actually going into the initial draft of writing that. I always struggle with how to do that in like a good way that doesn't come off as forced or just looks bad.
Yeah, that was fun. And I messed with that right up until the very end. I originally, when I first drafted the book, I just put the text messages in italics. And then I originally had emojis in there, but when I did the final draft for Jacob, I sat down and really decided and thought about like how I wanted the text messages to look on the book. And I found some better emojis. And then I took some bad words out and put emojis in instead. So that it was super fun kind of figuring that all out. And I've seen it done a bunch of different ways. So I just thought the text bubbles would work pretty well. And Jacob liked it. So
the two problems I have encountered when I have done that, one, the emojis themselves, unless I am on my phone, just having them present, like on the computer, you actually have to like search or I don't know. I use Google Docs usually for short stories. So, and then if I'm using if I'm writing a longer work in Scrivener, I don't even know if they have an emoji option. But so usually I do the old school Nokia, just like a colon and a parentheses or whatever, and I'll get to it later. But the bigger problem I have is it's usually when I'm writing younger characters, how do they text now? Oh. Because I don't have a lot of young people in my life that I, you know, communicate with via text. So it's like, what are they texting like teenagers when I was younger? Because that was, you know, just a lot of you, are, and, you know, just poor spelling and grammar. But now I have no idea.
Well, there for a while, it was just emojis. Like people use like holographs, which is like sending you full text messages and emojis, and you were supposed to figure it out.
Just went full Egyptian.
Yeah.
We regress.
I couldn't tell you. I actually went on a website and for those emojis, and I literally cut and pasted them into the text. So that's how I did it. Hmm. I just copied them, clicked them, and just stuck them in there. So
that's an easy way to do it.
Yeah.
So you've done, just working in publishing as well, you've come across, I would imagine, a lot of modern stuff. I don't know if you're actually reading the submissions or whatnot, but if you have, what do you think of the current landscape of young writers coming up and also their style of writing versus, you know, maybe when we were younger?
Yeah. So I did, you know, for a long time, I was the fiction editor and then the editorial director at Philadelphia Stories. I have passed the baton on to a new person. So I'm not doing that anymore, but I work with a lot of students, you know, as the MFA program director. For like 12 years, I've been teaching this class. I didn't do it this past fall, but up until last fall, I did it every semester. I did it every year, like starting in 2010, taught a novel workshop class where I got to read drafts of student novels. So I think we've read a lot of drafts of books in my day, I would say. At least the students in the program that I run, a lot of students are writing fantasy, writing epic fantasy, writing YA, which is different than when I got my MFA. Most people were writing literary fiction. There were some people writing fantasy and science fiction, but not as many as there are now in the program. Plus, I think the program's kind of made a name for itself. For YA and middle grade writers, especially, we've had some really successful alumni go on to do some really big things in those genres. So that's probably why we have so many students who want to write in that genre. But I don't know, like as far as like style or, I don't know, I think a lot of students that I see, a lot of young writers that I see are very interested in writing stories that speak to them. See a lot of stories with queer main characters, stories, you know, with BIPOC main characters. So, I mean, these are the kind of things I see, which I think it's all positive. It's all really good stuff. So,
sounds like it's mirroring the contemporary poetry scene a lot, where it's a lot of personal things rather than bigger ideas and themes. It's more centered on the self and identity, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, anything could be overdone, so you have to wonder at some point, maybe that'll start to change, just because when anything gets too popular, after a while, people stop reading it as much. But like you mentioned, the genres in literary fiction, I think, has fallen off a good bit lately in the last 5 or 6 years. Even like a lot of the bigger literary journals.
Yeah, I think, you know, oh, I'm sorry. I kind of missed the end. Were you talking about the literary journals kind of falling off? Is that...
Yeah, They just like a lot of the literary journals have just kind of like their sales have dropped and they just don't seem to have much of a readership. And I even wonder how many people are submitting to those now compared to even in the early 2000s.
Probably. Doing a print journal, you know, I was in, you know, very heavily involved in running Philadelphia Stories for 18 years, and putting out a print journal every quarter was a challenge, you know, just finding the money to pay for things, finding the money to pay the authors, do all of that. It was a ton of work. And so part of it is, I think traditionally these really big, well-known literary magazines were always kind of associated with a college or university that paid the bills. And there's been so many cutbacks in higher ed that what's happened is a lot of literary magazines have lost their funding. And if they can't figure out another way to pay for things, then they just end up folding, which is, you know, kind of sad, but it's kind of inevitable. You know, I think you're right, what you were saying about like maybe Stories now sort of focusing on the self a little bit more than they had previously. And I'm sure that that will continue for a while and then it will morph into something else. That's kind of the way it works.
Well, on the positive side, a lot of genre publications have popped up over the last couple years. And when I'm doing, like when I'm submitting work, I find that the genre stuff is way easier to get into now because there's so many up and coming anthologies and publishers and presses. And, you know, in the early 1920s and 30s, you had the pulp era, which was very popular, but then at some point that kind of dropped off and gave way to the literary fiction, which seemed to take precedence for a while. So it is nice to see there's a resurgence in that. And I like that, you know, like you were saying, you were dealing with a lot of fantasy stories, sci-fi, things that seem the general readers would be more interested in versus just like academic readers.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm seeing right now, and when I think about my work, is kind of a mashup of literary fiction and speculative fiction, you know, whether it's science fiction or fantasy or horror or suspense or whatever. I've kind of dabbled in all of those things, mostly science fiction and fantasy, but yeah, all kinds of things. So it's just kind of an approach. And there are a lot of, you know, science fiction and fantasy magazines out there. But the big ones that have been around for a long time, like Asimov's and fantasy and science fiction and some of the newer ones, but also very prestigious, like Clark's World and Uncanny, and those magazines are harder to get into than anything, I think. I think it's really hard to get into those magazines. So it can be really challenging. And I personally have had better success sending out my speculative short stories to literary magazines that have a broad readership than I have approaching traditional science fiction or fantasy markets. It's tough sometimes.
Well, when you get into the bigger names like Asimov and Clark's World, there's just so many submissions that you're probably not even getting read on. It's like submitting to the New Yorker. You're probably not getting your work read. You're just in a pile. I mean, they might get back to you with a rejection, but who's to say they actually read your work, you know? Yeah. Because one, those are all good pay markets too, I believe. And two, just the prestige of getting in one of those, that could really, not just a resume boost, that could actually elevate you to the point where publishers will start taking you more seriously. You have a book out and it's like, hey, you know, I was an Asimov, I was in this and that. And they'd be like, oh, this guy might actually have something worthwhile versus, you know, somebody who's published in No Name Weekly. It's just, it's a tough gambit to get into writing when you want to get your work read by a lot of people because the markets that and the publishers that actually have a big readership, it's like, good luck, you know? I personally don't know too many people who've been published in those kind of magazines outside of actual best-selling novelist and whatnot.
I have a pretty good friend who has been in both fantasy and science fiction and Asimov's probably more than once. He writes mostly fantasy and horror. His name's Greg Frost. Yeah, it's interesting because we were both kind of complaining the last time we were together about Uncanny. Now I'm just getting into that magazine. So it was just kind of funny. Because he's been published by those big magazines a lot. And yeah, it's challenging. I had a story sort of, well, it was that there's a I don't know if you guys are familiar with this magazine in Australia called Andromeda Spaceways. Mm-hmm. And it was like 8 months, right, from submission until final rejection. But I got this email from them somewhere along the way saying, you know, we really like your story. It's made it to the final round. But just so you know, only 20% of the stories that make it to the final round actually get published. And I, of course, was in that 80% that did not get accepted. But it was kind of an interesting experience. And I got feedback from the readers, which was really interesting, which normally doesn't happen.
Well, it's nice to know, too, that you were at least up in the top percentage for, you know, you made it to the next round. Unless there was only 10 submitters, then that would be terrible. But
I think there were a lot of submitters. But yeah, no, that always feels good. You know, anything better than like next is always better, right? It's always makes you feel good. So,
well, that's another tough thing I always tell new writers when they start submitting, because you have that little bit of a delusion. You're like, oh, I could submit to 6 places and I'll probably get in a couple. No. You're going to get a lot of rejections, and even if it's quality work, it's just the time you get into, you know, the time you submit something, who's actually the one reading it, what mood they're in. Often who you know helps a lot too in your cover letter. But one thing you mentioned I thought was interesting is you had more success with the literary magazines with your like speculative fiction. And I just think it's interesting because so many literary magazines I read, it's just like, or when I'm reading their submission guidelines, a lot of them, they'll say they will read it and accept that kind of stuff, but that's not what they're generally looking for. But I always thought, well, if it's something that's different, that's not going to read the same as all the other stories and poetry in their collections, I think that's worthwhile trying at least.
For sure. I had a story published in 2019 before the pandemic in December magazine, which is I entered the story in their Kurt Johnson prose contest and it made it to the finals. And I'm trying to remember, Ann Tyler was the judge. And I was just very excited that I was like in the top 10 of this contest and Ann Tyler was going to read my story. I did not win, but the editors liked the story that so much they decided to publish it. And the story was about this couple and how they are surviving this global pandemic. And it's pretty intense global pandemic. And then a year later, right, is COVID, right, is a real pandemic. And I got an email from the editor and she said to me, you know, I've had your story open on my coffee table for the past few months, and I just keep going back to it and reading it over and over again. And I said, yeah, I feel like it's haunting me a little bit. So she was like, it's kind of amazing how much you got right. And she's like, yeah, of course, you didn't get everything exactly right. But I'm like, yeah, it does. It is kind of freaking me out a little bit. And so they republished the story. And then it was also like in the reprint of Sequestrum. So, I mean, these are like more traditional literary magazines that are more open to like stories with like more speculative elements. I think what most more traditional literary magazines are probably not going to be interested in is, you know, epic fantasy, sword and sorcery kind of stuff, or really hard sci-fi. Although I'm sure if someone like, you know, Ted Chiang sent them a story, they would be more than happy to publish it. So,
well, that's what I always wondered. If the name's big enough, I feel like even if the story wasn't that good, they probably still publish it just because they put the name on the cover and people are going to buy it. Because in the end, they're still trying to sell books, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it does just have to do with the readership of the magazine as well. I think part of the reason I've had trouble getting into more traditional markets is because my stories are not necessarily that traditional. You know, they usually have female protagonists, you know, there's not a lot of sort of like, I don't want to say anything's going to make anybody mad, you know, but there's not a lot of stereotypical kind of tropes that you see sometimes in some of those magazines,
right,
in some of the stories. So yeah, I remember talking for a while, Carmen Maria Machado taught for us at Rosemont before she published her, you know, first short story collection and kind of got to be really famous or a little bit famous anyway. But she and I had talked about that, about how hard it was to kind of break into those bigger, more traditional markets. So,
I mean, just from different publishers we've spoken to, like one of the big things, if you want to get taken seriously with your submission, and it just goes to the, you know, the old slush pile, is if you're able to name somebody that's respected in the industry, like that, you know, you either know them or they read or reviewed your work in the past. Like that's always a good bump. And then, like I said, just it's really a matter of timing too. If you can get in early, that's always a good one. Like you mentioned Sequestrum, like that's one I always thought, it's like I don't think I would have a chance in there just from the volume of submissions they get. Any of those, especially if it's a good paying publication, it's like, there's so many people that you're competing against. And then the ones that charge a fee too, like that adds up over time as well. So it does get rough when you're just starting out until you can really establish your name a little more.
Yeah, I kind of have a little bit of an issue with literary magazines that charge submission fees, especially if they don't pay their authors. You know, it's one thing to charge a submission fee for a contest in a way, in that sense, you're kind of like buying a lottery ticket, especially if it's a big prize. Like at Philadelphia Stories, we ran a contest and the prize was $2,500. That's a lot of money for a short story. And there was a second and third place prize, which was like $750 and $500 for third place. So, you know, if we were charging like $15 to enter that contest, I don't think that that's such a bad thing. But we never charge submission fees for anything other than a contest. I know a lot of people argue about this, and like, again, I don't really want to make anybody mad. I just personally, and I think this is important too, like when you're doing this stuff, when you're submitting like short stories or poetry or essays to literary magazines, you just have to make a decision about like what you want to do. And that will change as you build your career out, right? So when I first started, I was shooting for like whoever I thought would be willing to publish me. And then as I got more publications, I started to be pickier. And then I sort of made a decision, well, I'm not going to submit to anything unless they're going to pay me something, even if it's only like $15. Mm-hmm. That just got to be kind of important for me. I don't know. I've gotten some good advice along the way, you know, from different people about making lists, hearing your submissions, you know, now don't just like send out 30 submissions to like your dream publication and then to like a brand new zine published by like four high school kids, you know, your chances of getting published by those guys are pretty high. Your chances of getting published by your dream publication are pretty low. But what happens if the high school kids contact you right away and they're like, well, your story, dude, we want to publish you. And then 2 days later, your dream publication is like, you're the next whoever, we really want to publish you. And you have to say no to them. Like ethically, you really have to say no to them because you've already said yes to someone else. So
I just recently had something similar. Could you open that door for him? The dog's going crazy over there. I think he wants to drink out of the toilet or something. Yeah, open that one. That's fine. I actually had that happen to me recently, though. I didn't get the acceptance thing from a bigger one, but I had a story sitting with Painted Bride Quarterly for like a year, and it just never went into progress or anything. And yeah. I was just like, all right, I'm done with this. So I submitted the story to a few other places. And then one of the places I submitted to, I think it's called Mini Mag. It's just like a digital only, and it's like a weekly publication maybe or something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's supposed to be something. I think it could be print. I don't remember, but I think what they do is they publish weekly for commuters, like on subways and stuff in New York. Mm. So I was like, okay. And I don't even remember why I submitted to them. I actually submitted a story that wasn't very good that I've been sitting on. I was like, I hope they'll take that one. And then I submitted the other one as well, just thinking, well, just in case, you know, maybe they'll like it or something. And then they almost immediately accepted the one story. And then I, when I reached out to Painted Bride Quarterly, you know, just to withdraw, they emailed me immediately. I was like, oh, sorry, we couldn't get back to you sooner. Congratulations on your acceptance. Like, why couldn't you have been that so speedy? Like, couldn't you have been that speedy with the reading of the thing, you know?
Oh, well, yeah, Painted Bride's a little notorious for hanging out to submissions for a really long time. So I'm sorry that happened to you. Yeah, they took a story that I submitted years ago. I had a story published by them, and they probably had it for a year, I think.
I mean, I don't remember if I paid a fee for them, but going with your anti-fee stance, there's one publication which I will not name. It's supposed to be a fast turnaround. I think it's a poetry publication. And I think that's also been going on a year where I haven't even gone into progress on Submittable. And that was a $10 fee to submit to them.
Oh.
And it's like, well, that's nice that, you know, I'm not ever going to get read and I pay $10. Can I get my money back maybe?
Wasn't there another one where you went to and it's like you had to pay, like, it was like a higher fee and they just gave you like a book?
Driftwood, what they do is you with your submission, which I don't mind it because you do get something. So what they do with their submissions, you can either get, usually it was $15 for a copy of whatever, I think it's just a random issue, but this time it was $30 for a random issue or for one of the novels that they publish. So I just went with the novel, and it sounds interesting. I don't remember the name, something Bark, but I mean, that's high, but at least you're getting something for that. But I have come across some places that the submission's $15 and you don't get it, and they don't pay either. That's the one that kills me. It's like you don't pay, but you have this high submission fee. That's a little ridiculous.
One thing I have noticed is that I think there's sort of a uptick in scam publications out there, and I think people need to really be careful of that. Places that are just like contest mills, you know, they're constantly running a contest. There's been some reporting on this. I don't know if you guys... Becky Tooch, she does a Substack about literary magazines, and she's written about this, and some other people have too. You got to be on the lookout for some of these things. Like, if it seems like it's a little bit too good to be true, like they say, it probably is. So
when it comes to the fees, I only pay if it's like the Missouri Review or something. And like they have a 10, especially the ones that have a higher option for quick turnaround. I appreciate those. So like a Missouri Review, one, I just, you know, I appreciate the work they put out anyway, so I'll pay the $10 and have a faster turnaround, and then usually they end up sitting on it for a while anyway, but then I know I'm getting the least feedback if they reject it, which is, I think, happened to me twice. But if it's just like a no-name online only, I'm not paying, even if it's $3 just for your submittable thing, I'm not paying that. Like, I don't want to do that. I have become a little, even though I haven't been published in a lot of things, because we've only really taken getting published seriously this past year. So I haven't been submitting probably as much as I should be to like bigger journals this year. But last year I submitted to a good bit, but I didn't really have the work. It was a lot of older stuff, so it wasn't new stuff that I really felt passionate about. But yeah, like I'll pay the fees for, you know, the Georgia Review or any of those bigger ones, or at least more respectable ones. When it comes to just these no-name ones, no. And then also, I mean, you brought up the scam ones. There's a lot that are just kind of vanity presses.
Oh, yeah.
Well, for instance, I just got into, I forget the whole title, PA Bards. They have a Southwest thing or something. So I got a poem published in their newest one coming out in April. And I only submitted because a buddy of mine, he submitted last year and got accepted. And I went to his poetry reading. And then this year, he submitted again, and we got accepted at the same time. But I kind of had a feeling that is one of those things that's like, yeah, they just probably accept anybody because you have to buy your own book. You don't get a contributor copy. And then they also charge you $5 to go and do the reading. I was like, well, I'm reading. Oh, wow. Why should I pay? You should pay me. So that's one of those things I think is just a vanity. Oh, I got a book, and it's like, okay, I'll put it on my shelf and never read it.
Yeah, unfortunately, those things have been around forever. You know, those kind of like, yeah, it's you know, publishing is not for the faint of heart. You know, whether you're trying to get stories or poems or whatever into literary magazines, you're trying to get a book published, you're trying to find an agent, you got to have a really thick skin. It's tough.
Well, and I apologize if you already touched on this earlier, but just for our audience, since, you know, besides the ones that aren't just drunks, there, a lot of our audience are aspiring writers themselves, actually being more established than we are. What advice would you give them for submitting and, you know, being able to get your work accepted more often than, you know, what they might be now?
There's a couple things I would say. First, I would say, and I don't mean this to sound however, but it's the truth, right? Just work on your craft. Write the best possible piece that you can write, whether it's a story, a poem, an essay, a book, whatever. And then don't internalize rejection, right? Which is super hard when people are telling you no all the time, to not feel like, oh, I suck, this is awful. Like, it's really hard not to feel that way. I know other people who feel this, you know, every rejection is just proof that you're out there working, that you're out there doing things, that you're active. So if you can figure out a way to not let every rejection make you feel like you need to go have a drink, that's probably really a good thing. And then finally, the truth of the matter is, especially with literary magazine publications, it's a numbers game. Like, if your work is as good as it can be, then it's just a matter of finding the right editor. Just because your story or your poem doesn't get accepted somewhere, and I learned this really early working at Philadelphia Stories, when I started reading all these submissions and realized there was a lot of really good stories that we just didn't accept. We didn't have room for them. It's too similar to something else we'd already published. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why you reject things that you reject stories that are really good. So you just have to keep sending them out there, and eventually you will find the right editor, the right person who will respond to your work. And when you find that editor, like, I've had some incredible conversations with editors. I don't know, as a writer, it just, knowing, even if it's just one person, knowing that you've like really connected with them on an emotional level is maybe some of the most satisfying experiences I've ever had. So it's totally worth it to just keep plugging away. That's what I would say.
And going on with your not taking rejections personally, don't take the, if it's negative feedback, personally either. I'm talking about reviews. I mean, like, say, say you submit somewhere, and I've had this from like random horror, I can't remember the name of it, one of the bigger horror publications. They liked, or they didn't like one of my stories, and they told me why. And then another one went around, and the same reasons that person didn't like them from the previous one, this reasons why they did like the story. So sometimes it's just an actual matter of taste. Some editors, they read something and it doesn't hit them right, and you might submit it somewhere else. Someone else might really love it. So you don't just immediately go, oh, they didn't like this, this must be terrible. Or 10 people didn't like this, it must be terrible. You can get the right person, and that's all that really matters. You know, you're only trying to get one.
Right.
I mean, you obviously want your dream publications first, but at some point you do have to accept just what you can get, and hopefully it's decent, and hopefully they pay. That's another one. I come across a lot of non-paying publications, and it's more about the prestige of getting published, and I'm like, yeah, but you're selling books that my story's in. I want some money. You know, even if it's $10, I just want something to show for my work.
Something you could say that, like, that technically you're a paid author.
Yeah.
You know, technically, like you said, it may only be $10, but, you know, it's something.
I mean, some of the one of the highest markets for short stories and even poetry pay-wise is a podcast. Mm. Like, a lot of bigger podcasts and fiction podcasts, they actually pay a decent money per story, and sometimes they're easier to get into than print publications because the rights are different. Like, a lot of them, it doesn't matter if you know your story's published somewhere, because eventually, usually it's like 6 months or so, I think the rights revert back to the author, so they don't care. They're not publishing the print version of it, so they could do whatever they want with the audio.
Right. Yeah. I've had some pieces accepted for audio journals, which was kind of fun. I had a piece like a long time ago. There was this journal in London called 4 minutes, 33 seconds. It was named after that like really famous piece of non-music by John Cage. So all the stories had to, when you read them, they had to be shorter than 4 minutes and 33 seconds. So it was basically flash. And that was really cool, because I think that was really one of the first journals that was audio only, and they don't publish anymore, but I don't know. They did invite me to come to a reading in London. I was like, well, that would be really nice, except I live in Philadelphia.
That would be really cool, though. Like, when do you get to say, oh, I did a reading in London?
I just sort of fantasized about it, but obviously was not able to go. But yeah, it was super fun. Sagi Meniscus published one of my short stories, and they did it as a podcast. And that was, you know, with sound effects and all kinds of stuff. That was really exciting. You know, and you get to hear a story that you've written, like performed like that. It's like, I don't know, it's a little bit of an out of body experience. It's like, wow, did I really write?
It always sounds so much more dynamic coming from somebody else than from you. And then, yeah, with the sound effects and everything, it's like, oh, this is like real professional. Like, it just is weird that you wrote that, because you're listening to it and it's almost like it's not your story. You know, it happens, but it just seems so new and fresh. That's a fun thing. So I definitely recommend anyone listening that if you do submit stories to places, try your hand at audio media, because it could be a lot of fun and very rewarding as well.
I totally agree.
There was another thing you just mentioned that actually, just to derail the conversation more, we will get back to your book briefly before, because we are going on 50 minutes here. Mentioned that one audio.
Yeah, if we don't, Tarina's going to kill me. So
you mentioned that one audio thing they are no longer publishing. That's probably one of the worst things if it's not a print book. Is the fact that if it's online only, even if it's a bigger name publication, they could just go away. And that's happened. Like, people have stories they submit and then, oh, it's gone. There's no link to it or anything. They went down, they went out of business, and then you don't have that proof anymore. So that's one that always sucks. That's why I try not to go to places that are online so much anymore. Usually I submit my not best work to those places. I know that sounds horrible, but at the same time, it's like, if it's not paying and it's online only, I don't think I want to submit something that I worked on for months at a time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't. I mean, sometimes there's just nothing you can do about it. I know, you know, early on, I have had several pieces in magazines that no longer exist. So that's the way it goes. But you can send them to somewhere else if you want. So
yeah.
I even worry about that with just some of like the genre places that we're getting into, like, you know what I mean? Like, there are a lot of smaller, just like one or two people kind of doing it. And it's just like, if you know, if you don't get enough books out when they first come out, like, and then like a year from now, you might find somebody else that wants like a copy of the book or whatever, and you can't get, there's no, you know, you can't get it anymore.
I mean, even big authors have come into, maybe not the biggest authors, but you know, the books go out of print and then the publisher just never wants to print them again. They don't do another run. And it's like, oh, well, if you want to buy this book, now it's on eBay for $500. Yeah, God damn it.
Yeah.
So, more strange than true. An hour later, I don't know what other questions I really have to ask about the book. I was going to ask if you're working on anything else or have anything other, you know, down the line here. But before we get to that, what is the release date of this book?
June 24th, I think, is the official pub date, but it'll be available, you know, in June.
So are you going to do like an actual like a book tour or anything, or do signings? Or I'm always interested to, because I know like Tyler Gore was doing readings of his.
Yes, I am actually, because I'm pretty old and this is my first book, I've decided to have what I have been billing as an inappropriately large launch party. I'm going to have like a giant blowout in South Philly and invite every human being that I know. If you guys want to come to Philly, you're welcome to come to the party. It's going to be on Friday, June 21st at the Mummer Museum. And I do plan to do some readings. I'm originally from Michigan, so I will be doing readings in the Philadelphia area, hopefully D.C., other Maine, maybe Chicago, other places where I know people and have friends that will help me get people to a reading, and then do some readings in Michigan. So that's the plan, but I'm working on all of that right now.
Have you released any excerpts anywhere that people can check out?
I have not. It's not a super easy story to excerpt. So there's not like chapters that really would stand alone as a story. And normally to like submit to a magazine or something, they really wanted to kind of read like a story. So I haven't really done much of that, but I actually haven't done any of that.
That's what I always that's what I always wondered when, you know, I come out with a novel. It's like, well, if it doesn't read like a, like, if, especially if it's not a cliffhanger style novel where a chapter ends with something that keeps the reader reading, you know, oh, I got to read the next one now. A lot of publishers, I don't think, want that on their, in their magazines or on their websites, because it's almost like, you know, classic literature, a lot of it, the first chapter or two, it's just meandering and long. There's a lot of stuff, getting to know the characters, world building, settings. And then it's just like, then you get into the story and it's interesting, but you can't just start in the middle with an excerpt unless it's really spicy or something. So I don't know the trick of that one. That's one I never actually looked up before, but I always thought that was a good avenue, because I have picked up books just because I read an excerpt in a, you know, a magazine or something. So any works down the line, anything else on your mind that maybe this needs to be the next novel?
Yeah, I'm just like 99.9% finished with a new book, which I'm going to start sending, you know, querying. It's called Kaiju Island, and
it's a great name.
Thanks. It has kaiju in it. It's got a lot of kaiju in it. And it's, I'm kind of obsessed with Godzilla. And I would say this book was definitely inspired by classic Japanese kaiju films and things like King Kong and even other American films like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, things like that. So it's historical, and in some ways it's very literary in that the story is told from multiple points of view and lots of different things, but that was super fun to write, and that's just about done. And I also have a short story collection that I'm querying too. So, and then I have another book that if it's in my head that I need to start writing soon, or my head's gonna explode. So,
well, no shortage of fun stuff. By the way, that kaiju book, just that's like right up my alley, like a literary monster story. Like I will have to check that out when you get that published. But promotion time. Do you have
what
website, social media, all that fun stuff?
I am on all the social medias pretty much. I don't really post on TikTok. I'm more of a cat video shanty lurker on TikTok. But I do post on Instagram, Facebook, X, and LinkedIn, you know, fairly regularly. Like if I do some promotion, I'll be out there, and you know, the occasional rant, and you know, a lot of pictures of food, things like that. My website is cjspataro.com. It's pretty easy. And any upcoming events or things that I have going on will all be posted on the website, and as soon as pre-ordering information is available, that'll all be posted there as well.
All right, excellent. Well, I wish you luck with the book. I hope it's a roaring success. Since I already have a copy, I'll probably start reading that here. Once I finally finish Don Quixote, I've been stuck on that for a while now, but once I finish that, I'm almost done with it. I might, because you're just the tag, like again, the Midsummer Night's tagline. I don't think it's really a tagline, but just the elements of that in there just made me really interested in it. So for you Shakespeare fans out there, even though it doesn't really have anything to do with Shakespeare, check it out. You'll like it. I promise. If not, Spencer will give you $5. Probably shouldn't say that. No. But
thanks, Spencer.
He's kind
Shakespeare
like
is sort of a character in the book, so a little bit.
All right. Well, we thank you folks for listening as well. If you want to follow us, and I guess the links for this episode, if you're not, well, that wouldn't make sense because they're already listening to it, but at DPW Podcast, we are on X, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. I probably should start a blue sky for this at some point. Seems like a happening place now, but yeah, I'll get there. Then Spencer, he's here as well, I guess. I don't know.
I'm over here.
You don't have anything to promote. And today I don't have any publication news. So again, thank you for listening, and we will check you all out next time. Bryce, what are you doing?
Trying to, you know, game.
What?
This game is really hard.
Pac-Man?
Yeah.
Dude, you're supposed to be playing the game for next week's episode of Arcade Bookshop.
I mean... I will. I'm really close to beating this.
Right. And what about the book?
Huh?
We're supposed to finish a book for the podcast, too?
Oh, yeah. I finished that last week. Yes!
Oh, did you finally beat it?
Uh-huh. The first level.
Oh, boy.
You can listen to new episodes of Arcade Bookshop every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your pods. You'll always find us with a controller in one hand and a book in the other.